Hello, on this week's program, a conversation with artist Jamie Wyeth. His series of paintings exploring the seven deadly sins is the basis of a new exhibition at the Brandywine Museum in Chester County. Susan Lewis explores the life and music of Joseph Haydn, considered the father of the symphony. The Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia opens its season this weekend with an all-Haydn program. We speak with Jerry Lynn Johnson, music director of the Black Pearl Chamber Orchestra, whose inaugural season opening concert takes place this weekend at the Kimmel Center. And David Patrick Stearns reviews the return of the New Jersey State Opera. The long-on-hiatus company came roaring back to life with a Verdi Requiem performance at the Great Auditorium in Ocean Grove. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
The seven deadly sins are a theme that has been explored artistically since the 6th century, when Pope Gregory I classified them as the most heinous of spiritual infractions. Lust, greed, sloth, pride, envy, gluttony and wrath have been depicted famously by Dutch medieval painters Hieronymus Bosch and Peter Bruegel the Elder, and in the mid-20th century in a comic book style by the American artist Paul Cadmus. In literature, Dante's Inferno and Chaucer's Canterbury Tales reference them. And in popular culture, the 1995 movie Seven had the sins as its theme, and a soon-to-be-released video game will also allow players to explore this septuplet of human vices. Painter Jamie Wyeth, son of Andrew Wyeth and grandson of N.C. Wyeth, has approached the topic with a more contemporary eye and has chosen to pluck images from nature to illustrate the sins. These paintings are now the centre of an exhibition at the Brandywine River Museum in Chester County. Now age 63, Andrew Wyeth has been painting for over 40 years, and since the death of his father Andrew Wyeth earlier this year, is the patriarch of one of America's most revered artistic families. I met with Jamie Wyeth earlier this week at the Brandywine River Museum. There have been representations of the seven deadly sins in art going back to Hieronymus Bosch, Bruegel the Elder. Your references are more recent, the Paul Cadmus paintings from the 1940s and Dante's Inferno.
Mm-hmm.
How did they inspire, how did they prompt you in this direction?
Well, you know, curiously enough, it's hard for me to pin down. I think it came from a dream I had one night, and I woke up in the middle of the night and all of a sudden thought, why not the seven sins? I've always been fascinated by Dante, and I've read so many of these things, Paradise Lost, Milton, and I just thought, well, why can't it be today, the contemporary? And then after I got sort of involved in it, then I thought back, well, where did I really sort of tune into this? And the Paul Cadmus paintings, a mentor of mine named Lincoln Kirsten owned the seven paintings. And so I remember seeing them. They're very small paintings, rather sort of cartoony.
But quite horrific in their own way.
But terrifying, yeah, very terrifying. But more of a cartoon sort of thing. But they stuck in my mind. And then I became completely obsessed with this and tried to read as much as I could about it. I didn't want it to be sort of a Christian, you know, sort of thing, but so much of it is in the liturgy and all that sort of thing. So it's and then I thought, well, why not bring it right up to present times?
You chose seagulls as an allegory for the seven sins, and the thought occurred that when you hear that somebody's going to represent the seven deadly sins of seagulls, that it's brilliant because you can clearly see almost all of these traits in the behavior of seagulls. Were there any of the seven traits that were more difficult? I'm thinking maybe pride or sloth, or did it all just flow?
It actually pretty well flowed. And why seagulls is that I live alone on an island, and the only other inhabitants are seagulls. And they're ready models, and there they were. And I thought, my God, why not? You know, this could be a fit. And I didn't want to anthropomorphize them and make them sort of cute and so forth. And so many of what I depicted were scenes that I've actually had seen with the gulls. And gulls, you know, so often in paintings, they're painted as sort of white doves and these cute little seabirds. Well,
and they're
not. They're vicious scavengers and attack one another, eat one another. And so I thought, this works.
In the exhibition on the wall opposite the actual seven paintings are seven other works. Are they sketches? Are they ideas being worked out? Or are they just paintings of seagulls?
Some are leading up to it. Obviously, the large work Inferno had a lot to do with the seven sins. And then there are three newer paintings called the Carnegulls, and those are sort of the retribution of the gulls after the sins. I mean, if you notice, they're bursting into flames and so forth. So I spent 2 years in this and completely obsessed with this. It now kind of doesn't make sense to me, but at the time it seemed very right.
But it'll make sense to viewers when they see the paintings and to understand that, again, you're not anthropomorphizing, as you say, the seagulls, but they are very, very vivid representations. Were there any other versions of these vices as you painted?
Sure, I tried, but amazingly enough, I stuck pretty much to my dream that night. I mean, I got up at 3 in the morning and did just very, it looked like hieroglyphics on a piece of paper, but that was the nugget that I really based all 7 on, and really, when I look back at that, I found that little paper recently in my studio. It's pretty close, you know.
Was this...
Maybe it was an epiphany.
Sure.
A seagull epiphany.
Was this easy to work within the confines of this theme? Because this isn't something that you've typically done before, but to be given the narrative before you start the work, was that a comfortable area to work in, a comfortable boundary to work in?
It was new for me, and interestingly enough, it more harks back to my grandfather, N.C. Wyeth, I think, working on a theme and so forth. So that sort of intrigued me once I was into it. But I've done series before. I've done series of paintings of a young boy, an island boy, Orca Bates, and there have been other series. But this was really a thematic thing, which was, yeah, sort of a departure for me.
You mentioned your grandfather, and it's very difficult to speak to you, I'm sure, about your father, our condolences. How much has his passing meant to you in terms of the, I'm loath to use the word dynasty, but you are now the elder Wyeth. Has that struck you?
Well, sure. I mean, it's pretty scary to think of it. But the, you know, the wonderful thing about a painter is that when a painter dies, they never really die. They leave their work. And that has been, I mean, coming here to the Brandywine Museum, you know, I love coming in, and particularly since my father's death, I think, because there he still is in the walls. I mean, he lives in his work, and that to me is limitless, you know. So the finality of it probably really hasn't hit me. Obviously, I miss him as a person, but his, you know, the blur between he and his work is such a blur that it's very hard to make the distinction.
And how much, and is it more so now that your father and even your grandfather is living in your hands? I mean, in the work you're producing, are they still intact?
Sure, but they're such strong forces themselves that they unto themselves have become such a force. And then there was the precedent. My father worked with his father and so forth, and his death, I think, had a huge effect on my father, really changed his direction of work. I'm yet to see. Now, maybe the 7 sins have come out of this. I don't quite think so. But what I'm probably not going to do are the 7 virtues of seagulls, that's for sure.
More difficult.
Yes, I don't think so. I'll get into that.
Jamie Wyeth. His depictions of the 7 deadly sins and related works form an exhibition now at the Brandywine River Museum in Chester County. 7 Deadly Sins runs through November 22nd.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
18th century composer Franz Joseph Haydn has been called the father of the symphony and the father of the string quartet. This year marks the 200th anniversary of his death and has been designated as the Year of Haydn by musical groups around the world. Now, as the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia opens its season with an all-Haydn program, WRTI's Susan Lewis considers the man and his music.
Haydn's 16th Symphony was, relatively speaking, one of his early symphonic works in a career that spanned 6 decades. Born in 1732, Joseph Haydn would write more than 100 symphonies and over 80 string quartets, as well as dozens of other forms, including operas, masses, oratorios, concertos, piano trios, and pieces for solo piano. While he spent much of his life working at the court of a wealthy family in Austria, midway through his career, he began to publish his work. Temple University Associate Music Professor Stephen Zohn says once his music was available, Haydn's reputation took off.
It sold well. Later on, he got invitations. The most famous was to come to London for 2 concert seasons, and he ended up writing a set of symphonies. He presided at the keyboard at these performances. He wrote his 2 late great oratorios. Haydn became the most famous composer in Europe by the 1790s.
Haydn's symphonic structure became a model for other composers, with an opening fast movement, or allegro, a slow second movement, a third, minuet, and an allegro at the end, although Haydn himself switched them around when it suited him. He explored the possibilities of the string quartet, writing equally for each instrument and paving the way for those to come, including his friend Mozart. In compositions, he would continually play with a theme, developing it repeatedly, a technique that later appears in the works of many other composers, including Beethoven, who was, for a time, Haydn's student. Yet Haydn is sometimes characterized as a composer with less gravitas than these contemporaries.
Haydn developed a reputation in the 19th century for being this kind of jovial character who wrote pleasing and clever music, but not terribly deep. Towards the end of his life, he was known as Papa Haydn.
People tend to write him off as lacking depth, and that is certainly not the Haydn that I've come to know.
Miles Davis, principal bass with the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia, says he finds great variety in Haydn's music.
This program is a great example. We've got an early symphony in B-flat major. It's very light, effervescent, like champagne. It's so sparkling.
This contrasts with Symphony No. 49, which Davis says shows the darker, more introspective, and harmonically inventive Haydn.
Rather than starting with a fast movement or a slow introduction and then going into an allegro, the whole movement is an adagio in F minor and very sort of dark. And for a composer that was considered a bright, sunny guy, I think it shows a lot of his searching and inventive side.
This searching and inventive side may have been sparked by his circumstances. When Haydn's music-loving, working-class parents saw musical talent in their 6-year-old son, they sent him off to choir school. By the age of 8, Haydn was a choir boy at St. Stephen's Cathedral in Vienna. But after his voice broke, he had to find a way to make a living. After some freelance teaching and composing, at 25, Haydn secured his first full-time position as music director at the home of a minor aristocrat. A few years later, he moved to the court of the wealthy Esterházy family, first as assistant, then at age 35, as full Kapellmeister. A big job, says Temple's Steve Zone.
You'd have to do everything from making sure that all the court string instruments had strings and all the keyboard instruments were in good repair, to writing music for important occasions, directing rehearsals. So basically, the Kapellmeister oversaw everything and was pretty much in charge of the music.
Despite such challenging organizational and creative responsibilities, the Kapellmeister was considered one of the staff. He wore livery.
All the court employees had to wear the same uniform, and that puts it in perspective. Like, you're like the butler, you just happen to write music.
Yet Haydn emerged from this ordinary station to become world-renowned. Zone says despite the volume of musical work expected of him at court, or maybe because of it, Haydn was constantly seeking new ways to write a symphony, a quartet, even the most insignificant chamber piece.
The famous quote of Haydn's early career, looking back, he said, well, because I was so isolated, I was forced to become original. But he also, I mean, he had the guts to experiment.
And he also had a great orchestra that he worked with. It was like the Duke Ellington band of its day. And he was always writing for people that he knew well. And I think it was a journey of invention for both the composer and the musicians.
In 1783, Haydn wrote his Cello Concerto No. 2 in D major for cellist Antonín Kraft of the Esterházy Orchestra. Cellist Wendy Warner plays the work with the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia. Warner, who says while she naturally identifies with composers like Barber and the Russian Romantics, she is particularly drawn to the second movement of the Haydn Cello Concerto, which demonstrates that this coolly classical composer could also be intense and full of yearning.
It starts very pure. It's very simple, actually. But it grows into this passionate section where it goes into minor and it gets very dark and turbulent, and then it returns back to the theme.
At times, light and airy, or dark and passionate, Haydn also had a sense of humor, which he sometimes expressed musically, as in the Surprise Symphony.
And the idea he was trying to wake up an inattentive audience.
And in the Joke Quartet, Haydn appears to end the work, only to start it up over and over again. ¶¶ To some, Haydn's humor may mask his genius. To others, it may exemplify his willingness to take risks, to push boundaries and move music forward. Franz Joseph Haydn, 77 years on this earth, created hundreds of musical compositions that live on, both in themselves and in the musical possibilities they've sparked in others.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia opens its season with an all-Haydn program, including Symphonies 16 and 49 and Haydn's Cello Concerto No. 2 in D minor, featuring soloist Wendy Warner. Performances are tomorrow afternoon at 2:30 and Monday evening at 7:30 at the Kimmel Center's Perelman Theatre. Jerry Lynn Johnson, the former assistant conductor for the Chamber Orchestra of Philadelphia, is the founder and music director of the Black Pearl Chamber Orchestra. Touting a roster of culturally diverse musicians, the orchestra plays free concerts to raise awareness and appreciation of classical music. Johnson says she hopes that through connections to other arts organizations in Philadelphia, her ensemble will encourage audiences, quote, beyond spectatorship to participation in the musical experience. Black Pearl is developing collaborations with institutions such as the Free Library of Philadelphia and the Philadelphia Orchestra, and this evening hosts its inaugural season-opening concert at the Kimmel Center. I spoke with Jerry Lynn Johnson recently and first asked her why she had formed Black Pearl Chamber Orchestra.
I started Black Pearl because there were some changes in the classical music that I wanted to see in terms of how orchestras operate and how they relate to the community. And I thought the best way to do that was to really create the changes that I wanted to see from the ground up. And so some of the things I wanted to see more in classical music was more diverse audiences, more diverse people in the orchestra itself, in the administration, as well as on the stage. And as well, I wanted to see kind of more of a shift in terms of how orchestras relate to the community, in terms of that presenting concerts is one aspect, but also really taking an active role in arts education and helping, I think, civic organizations and business organizations and educational institutions really bridge the gap in terms of giving kids exposure and access to classical music and other art forms as well.
And what are you doing differently that the existing orchestras aren't doing?
Well, I think the difference will be apparent when people come to our concerts and they see the musicians walk out on the stage. We recently did a performance, and the audience was extremely diverse. We had African Americans, European Americans, Asian Americans, Latin Americans, all kinds of people from different economic backgrounds, cultures in the audience. And when the orchestra walked out, the orchestra was equally as diverse as the audience. And so it was amazing to kind of see pictures of the stage and the audience together, and there was no clear demarcation in terms of the kinds of people that were on the stage versus the kinds of people that were in the audience. And I think the audience was excited to see that as well.
This is not a great time to be starting any kind of new cultural endeavor. How difficult has it been?
Yes, I think if I had it to do over again, I probably would not start an arts organization in the midst of one of the greatest economic crises in our country. But I couldn't help the timing. I saw the need and decided to address the need immediately. And in terms of starting an organization right now, I think, you know, I've really tried to, you know, make lemonade out of the lemons of the economy and really take the opportunity to say we've gotten some wonderful grants and some wonderful funding from a variety of institutions. And so how can we really put the economic resources that are coming from the state and from these other organizations, how can we put those back into the people of the state of Pennsylvania and specifically the city of Philadelphia?
So if you can make it now, you can make it anytime.
It's easier than I thought, and it's more difficult than I thought. But I think also that the opportunity to go to wider sources of funding means that changes our perception of what our responsibilities are as an arts organization. Rather than satisfying two or three you know, wealthy donors and their vision for what they want the art form to do, we are really putting the Black Pearl Chamber Orchestra at the service of the people. Our concerts right now are free to the community, and I think that's important because we want people to feel that this is their music, this is their orchestra, and we welcome anyone and everyone from the community to come to our concerts. In addition to that, our programming is such that we want to encourage people from different communities and different cultural backgrounds to see that people like them have been contributing to classical music from throughout history. So there's a number of African-American contributions to classical music and Latin American contributions that we'll be showcasing at our concert today. It's partially a celebration of Hispanic Heritage Month, and so we're doing a number of Latin American composers from a variety of countries.
What's the long-term goal for this organization?
Long-term goal for this organization, obviously we want to continue to grow. We want to expand the number of concert offerings that we have. We also want to do a little bit of touring, and you know, not extensive across the United States, but we want to really have a presence in the Northeast Corridor. But we really want to send the message that diversity is good business in classical music, and I think that other larger arts organizations around the country will start to really seek out the top African-American, Latin-American classical music talent that is out there and is readily available. And I think they'll start to see a change in the number of different community members who then come into the concert hall.
Jerry Lynn Johnson, music director of the Black Pearl Chamber Orchestra. The ensemble plays its inaugural season opening concert this evening at the Kimmel Center's Perelman Theater. The program features works by Beethoven, Piazzolla, and Javier Alvarez. Ocean Grove has always been a destination of one sort or another, but last weekend some 3,200 music lovers created lines that snaked around the town's quaint Victorian square for a new festival called Destination Opera. The newly resurrected New Jersey State Opera is establishing a mainstay at the seaside town, a 90-minute drive from Philadelphia and a similar distance from New York City. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns was on hand for last weekend's performance.
The nickname used to be Ocean Grave. That's not just because Ocean Grove is dry from an alcohol standpoint. The town exists to be a quiet summer camp for Methodists seeking spiritual renewal and, more recently, a buffer from crime-ridden Asbury Park. It took the 34-year-old conductor Jason Tram, the opera company's artistic director and music director of Ocean Grove's expansive 115-year-old Great Auditorium, to recognize the area's festival potential. The auditorium is often compared to an upside-down Noah's Ark, and, says Tram, has rare acoustical immediacy.
The wood is like a Stradivari violin. All the choirs that sing here, they sound better because of the acoustic. So I figure if you put great classical art here, it's going to be exciting. And the added beauty of the ocean and the added beauty of the Victorian architecture and the added beauty of this interesting, vibrant, fun community really said to me that I think this could work.
Fully staged opera will require some significant reconfiguration in the Great Auditorium, and at the moment, much of the New Jersey State Opera's energy is directed towards producing Porgy and Bess next year in Newark. Opera per se has been confined in Ocean Grove to small-scale pieces at the Youth Temple. Religious communities can't always be counted on to embrace an art form as blazingly secular as opera, though Tram has encountered only encouragement.
The organization that basically runs this facility, they've been just nothing but supportive. Culture is part of their mission. So we've always had famous opera singers sing in Ocean Grove. Caruso sung here. So I think the history is very, very helpful.
A panel discussion last Friday afternoon brought together various civic leaders, including those from the adjacent Asbury Park, the town that once kept people away from Ocean Grove. But the area crime rate is way down, business is up, and beach attendance hit an impressive 600,000 this year. Does anybody need further convincing of Opera Destination's viability? No, says Asbury Park Director of Commerce Tom Gilmore.
We don't have to convince anybody. I think it's already happening here. The question is now, how can we really expand upon this?
The Saturday Requiem will have legs beyond Ocean Grove. It was taped for broadcast on New Jersey Public TV in November and will be available on DVD through the New Jersey State Opera. The production costs came in estimated in the low six figures, a very good deal, thanks to a collaborative spirit from the Musicians Union as well as All Mobile Video. That company is usually in residence at the Metropolitan Opera, but was able to fit in Ocean Grove with a few weeks' notice, says rental services director Tom DeAngelo.
I see it akin to summer stock, where Jonathan says he'll show up with the nails and I'll show up with the hammer, and we'll put on a broadcast.
Not every hall looks better under ultra-bright TV lights, but the Great Auditorium does, and what looks better often seems to sound better. Not that the Great Auditorium acoustics need any help. Vocal soloists are key casting. They're as important here as in any Verdi opera, and the performance was lucky to have a solid, though second-string, lineup. One exception was tenor Franco Tonelli from the Republic of Georgia. Conductor Tram, it would seem, knows how to discover potential stars. Somehow, problems with the performance matter less at Ocean Grove than they might at, say, Carnegie Hall. Isn't that the way summer festivals so often are? The setting should make you happy to be there for any reason, and Ocean Grove qualifies on that front. The sea air, the 1890s time warp quality of the village, the majestic expanse of the auditorium itself. Somehow, the music felt like a bonus. Whoever named this festival Destination Opera knew the considerable value of the destination.
Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. And that's it for now. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ribchester, and performed by Symphony in C under Rossin Milanoff. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.